Welcome to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey Podcast.
I'm Lucia Kelly, expert at applied analysis and lupine wavelength hemoverifying.
And I'm Tali Franks, media critic, fanfic enthusiast, and it's good to be a lunatic.
And we're here today to talk about Tooth and Claw, the second episode of Series 2 of Doctor Who.
Tooth and Claw aired on April 22nd, 2006. It was written by Russell T. Davies and directed by Euros Lyn.
Reminder that time isn't a straight line. It can twist into any shape, and as such, this is a fully spoiled podcast. We might bring things in from later in the show, the comics, the books, the audio dramas, or even fan theories and articles.
With that out of the way, there's a lot of unfinished business in this house. So let's get in the TARDIS.
Okay, so the first thing I want to point out, because I did look up the Wikipedia page for this, just for the plot summary. The plot summary on Wikipedia does not mention the highly controversial kung fu monk scene that actually opens this episode. And I'm like, that's a choice. Listen, I love this episode. It's a bit of a mess.
This episode is a bit of a mess. And I will say, full disclosure, this is the second time we are recording this episode, because the first time we recorded this episode, I had a less than generous take on Tooth and Claw. And it's not that I hate this episode. It's not that it's a terrible episode. It's that I have to be in a certain mood to watch it. There's a bit of a je ne sais quoi about this episode that makes it, sometimes I love it, sometimes it makes me want to pull my hair out. I call it the Stephen Moffat effect.
Which is remarkable, because he didn't even write this one.
I know, he didn't write this one. Russell T. Davies wrote this one. But this episode reminds me of Stephen Moffat in a way I can't really explain.
The racism definitely jumps out, like, a lot, in a way that's just like, like, not, we're not even talking about the monks here. We're like the way Queen Victoria is like, oh yeah, also I'm the head of an empire and the Empress of India. And that's just completely, not only glossed over, but kind of like, ooh, she's the Empress of India. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of funny that I call it the Stephen Moffat effect. I think it's because I hate Moffat's era so much that I name it after him. And it's something that we were talking about actually in our Eve of the Daleks episode. One of the things that we were talking about is that people tend to look at RTD with rose-colored glasses. And one of the things that is good about looking back at his older season is that we can examine the ways in which he actually made a lot of not great moves. He made a lot of mistakes that I feel people forget about. And I think one of the interesting things about when we think of Chibnall's era and how it has so many glaring errors when it comes to how it portrays race, how it portrays different kinds of marginalization. Part of the reason it's so obvious is because Chibnall is making an obvious effort, and in many ways he has failed in certain places. But because the racism and some of the forms of marginalization in RTD's era and later on in Moffat's era are so casual and so unexamined, they fly beneath the surface, it's easy to not notice for a lot of people. And because it's easy to not notice, people may think that this is a new problem for Doctor Who, when in fact it's always been a problem. Like, Victoria and her portrayal, very racist. very classist. Also, the monk kung fu scene, like, that is not okay at all.
There is no possible explanation for how that would even occur. You literally just wanted to do a kung fu scene, but you set it in Scotland. Like, And speaking of Scotland and unexamined biases, I find it so fascinating. In the midst of all this, you know, racism, there's also weird nationalism undercurrents, because this is the one episode where David Tennant gets to use his natural accent, right? Like, the fact that Christopher Eccleston had to fight to use his natural accent in the first season. And that was a huge thing, because there's a huge issue with having a person in power in a popular TV show having a not, you know, RP English accent across the board in English media, but especially with the BBC. And then to just go right back and say, like we could have had a Scottish doctor from season two, and that didn't happen.
Yeah, and honestly, that's part of why I love Capaldi's doctor so much, because he did get to use his accent.
Right?
Why I like Whitaker's doctor so much, because she does get to use her accent. I just love that for them so much, and it makes me so sad that Tennant doesn't get to use his accent. And like, Tennant gets to use his accent so infrequently that I am constantly forgetting. I'm constantly forgetting that he even has one. I have to make a cognitive effort to remember that he has a Scottish accent.
That is also an erasure of identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very specific to this region of the world, in that, like, in the very particular politics of England versus Scotland, Wales and Ireland, but it's also a worldwide issue as well. It's something that I always notice and I always take a lot of ire with, because it's something that Australian actors have to deal with all the time because of the way that the film industry works and complications with all sorts of stuff that I don't need to get into. But basically the end of the line is that most Australian actors that make it big do so by going over to America, and the only way that they usually get jobs, unless they're being a joke Australian character, is to put on an American accent. You will not get work otherwise. And it's just bullshit, and I hate it. And the world is wide and varied and diverse in all kinds of multiple ways, and people should be allowed to use their natural accent for whatever job they want.
Yeah, the amount of actors who I've, to my surprise, realized are British or Australian because they've been acting in American projects, I'm like, wow. Because it's just not something that is noticeable to Americans, because it's not something that's advertised. It's something that I've had to make an effort to learn. And because I don't really pay attention to media, because I don't usually care about movies or TV very much outside of Doctor Who. I love Doctor Who and I really like Marvel, but outside of Doctor Who and Marvel, I don't really watch media very often. It's like Doctor Who, Marvel, BBC Merlin, and Buffy first. That's basically the TVs that I watch. I don't pay attention to actors. Whenever I learn information about an actor, it's almost always involuntary. So like, it'll pop into my frame of views that I'll be like, I didn't even know that.
As the film nerd between us, it happens a lot. As someone who does pay attention to that kind of stuff, who looks up cast members, who tries to read every bit of trivia I can and watches a not reasonable amount of movies and TV, once you start noticing it, you can't stop noticing it. It's wild. And I just want to ask all of our American listeners, hello, I love you, hi. You can understand me, right? You can understand Talia, you can understand me. We've been talking about this for over a season now. You can understand an Australian accent. It's possible. Let us use our accent.
Yeah, no, it's kind of funny. I call myself a media critic at the beginning of every episode, but mostly what I mean by that is that
you're a fanfic critic.
No, I'm a fanfic critic, but also I read a lot of books. Most of the media that I critique is literature. I read a lot of books and I watch specific TV shows, but it's mostly books. I read books, I review books, but I don't watch things.
We have gotten off topic. So the doctor introduces himself as, it's actually really cute. He introduces himself as James McCrimmon, which was a companion of the second doctor. He was a Scottish piper from the 18th century. So the real James McCrimmon could absolutely be wandering around the hillsides. But that was just a little cute moment. But they all head over to the Torchwood Estate. Spooky, spooky, very cool. Oh my gosh, is that a plot thread? Possibly. And cool things are happening. Spooky things are happening. The monks have stolen everyone.
Okay, I want to just address something that I've noticed is a pattern in this season. Mm-hmm. And it's the pattern of the Doctor and Rose getting split up.
Right? It's weird. And I mean, this was a problem with Rose in season one as well. It's wild that Rose is seen as the ultimate companion, the companion that the Doctor fell in love with, right? Like, OTP, whatever. They are so rarely written as a team. They are so rarely written together. They are so rarely written as working together. Or like, I was noticing just how like all of their banter, you're right, you're absolutely right. It's very Moffat-esque in this like, I don't know. Again, in Eve of the Daleks, I had a bit of a rant about American rom-coms. And like, it's giving me that energy of like, do you actually like each other? I get that it's meant to be playful, but like, I don't know. I wasn't super feeling it. Also, the Are You Amused joke gets tired really, really quickly. I'm done.
I get so tired by that joke. And I feel like, okay. So I feel like it's a trait of companions that they have to get separated from the doctor in order to have their autonomy, be the hero of their own story, do their own thing. Think about how in season three, there's that big example of Martha goes wandering the earth on her own. It's not unusual for the doctor and a companion to be split up and work separately to solve a problem. The thing that I find interesting about the way that the doctor and Rose are split up is that, I guess I'm finding it hard to articulate. Rose is an interesting dichotomy for me because she's on the one hand very independent, but on the other hand very dependent and tied to the doctor in a way that feels toxic to me.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the strong female character thing, right? Women are allowed to be strong and independent and compassionate and empathetic and whatever, and write their own story and do whatever. But we also have to always remember that, make no mistake, they are attached to a man. Right? And that in the end, it's all about love for the man. It's really insidious how the idea of the strong female character was pitched as this step towards feminism and written for women. And that's why it's a trope, right? That's why it's strong female character and not just a strong female character, is that it's a trope and it's a trope that specifically feeds straight back into patriarchal thinking. It gives the illusion of independence and power while really tying you closer to the patriarchy. and specifically the idea of white feminism that is not intersectional.
Yeah, and I also think the thing about Rose and Ten that bothers me about this episode, and the reason that, again, sometimes I love it and sometimes I hate it, is because the episode is simultaneously dark and lighthearted, because it's such a dark episode. It's so grim. So many people die. It's an episode that's steeped in death and in empire and in racism. And yet the Doctor and Rose are making jokes the whole time. And then Victoria has that moment at the end where she says, "I know that you can sort with stars and magic and think it fun, but your world is steeped in terror and blasphemy and death, and I will not allow it. We'll leave these shores and you will reflect, I hope, on how you came to stray so far from all that is good and how much longer you may survive this terrible life. Now leave my world and never return." And that's a really ominous warning that ultimately means nothing, because they just laugh it off. They just go.
But I don't think it does mean nothing, though, because I think, I mean, it's the Torchwood estate, right? Like, this is the establishment of Torchwood. I would say that that line, and specifically tying it to Queen Victoria, who then starts Torchwood, is kicking off the foreshadowing for Doomsday. Throughout the whole of season two, we are reminded again and again and again of this idea that, like, Rose wants to stay with the Doctor forever. And, like, literally everything is saying, like, it's not going to happen. Literally the whole universe at every turn is like, prepare yourself for heartbreak, because that's not possible. It's not going to happen. Something's going to break. Something's going to wreck this. And you guys aren't taking it seriously. Like, I think that's actually very, very deliberate.
I guess what I mean by when I say it means nothing is it doesn't mean nothing in the sense that there's no ultimate consequences for it. I mean that Rose and the Doctor ignore the warning and they ignore the consequences that are coming for them. And they just keep pushing forward regardless. And I feel like season two for me, the reason I dislike it so much is because there's such a weird imbalance of high stakes in this sort of jokester quality that feels so dissonant. Because you're right, Rose and the Doctor almost never take anything seriously. There's constantly all of these warnings and they're just constantly ignoring them. And I think the core of why it bothers me is because what it's really about is about privilege. And it's about the fact that Rose and the Doctor are just tearing through the universe, taking advantage of their privilege. And not exactly wrecking everything they touch, because they do save the world in many cases. But in many places, where they leave things isn't good. If you think about it, when they leave Tooth and Claw, the Torchwood estate is devastated. All these people are dead. When they leave Love and Monsters, that whole fun little group of friends is dead. When they leave New Earth, there's that whole new group of humans, but all the nuns are gone. Girl in the Fireplace, Renette has been abandoned. Rise of the Cybermen end up coming back, and Doomsday is the consequences. So much of where they leave isn't necessarily worse for them being there, but it isn't necessarily better. And I think what really stresses me, and also Idiot's Lantern, which We'll get there.
We'll get there.
Get there. But
oh my god. See, that's what bothers me about how Rose is so often held up as the working class hero. And I'm like, in what universe? Because she's not written that way. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, there are all these jokes about how Rose wants everyone to join a union and she's always asking after everyone. No, the working class hero companion that you're thinking of is Donna Noble. She's the working class hero. Rose is what happens when a person who is not from the background of the character they're writing is trying to write something and just writes them as themselves. Rose does not read as working class. She doesn't. She's dressed working class. She's got the accent. She's got the technical background. But in terms of like how she actually behaves and how she interacts with others, it reads so much more as middle-class white woman looking to save someone. And that is such a different aspect. That is such a different outlook. You are coming at it from an entirely different angle than what you think you're coming at it as.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the thing about Rose too, which I constantly struggle with, and I struggle with a lot about Rose, but I struggle so much with her inconsistent writing.
So much. Like,
it's just
the way I would love Rose Tyler if she was consistently written. Honestly, if she was consistently written as what I think they were aiming at, which is that working class hero vibe, I would adore her. But she's just not.
No, and the thing is, even if they were going to consistently write her as that white savior, middle class white woman, I would like her more. If they just picked one, I could deal with it. But they don't. If they consistently wrote her as a 19-year-old, I could do it. If they consistently wrote her as mid-20s, I could do it. But they don't consistently write her. She's not consistently written. And there's all these different versions of Rose. And I like some of them. I like some versions of Rose. But the fact that she's not consistent is the problem.
And especially not examined by the narrative at all. She is not held accountable by the narrative at all. If she was written, as you say, as, you know, middle-class white savior complex, but that was acknowledged and put in, like, we are meant to see Rose as complicated, right? And as trying to do this thing and achieving this other thing, and how the way that she helps is both self-serving and not actually helpful. Like, I was just talking about how much I love Sarah in Eve of the Daleks. Like, I love when an unlikable character is written well, because then that's actually a really good character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's just not there. And I think the reason that Rose is so beloved is I actually think it's because she's so inconsistent that people just pick and choose and then self-insert whatever they think their version of Rose is. But when you actually look at the text, it's just not there. And it's really unfortunate. I want to like Rose.
Yeah. Especially since she's absolutely everywhere. And... No, because Rose pervades everything after her. Everything after her is just soaked in Rose. Every companion after Rose is compared to Rose. And if you think about it, the companion that's truly that self-starter, independent, is able to think on her feet and work on her own and is consistent is Martha. Martha is the companion who has that autonomy and is able to like do the work. And Martha is the companion who was able to, at the end of her season, say, no, I'm good. Mm. You don't value me the way that I need to be valued. I'm going to leave. Martha's the companion that we need, but Martha is too good for the doctor. And mm-hmm. I really hope she comes back for the centenary celebration. I love that. Also, she's the one that makes sense because she and Ryan, and I guess Graham, are the only companions who had clean exits. Every other companion in Doctor Who had a messy exit, except for the two Black companions who were like, no, I'm good. Even Bill, who had a messy ending, was the one who chose to leave. Mm-hmm. She left the Doctor for dead. It's hilarious. But I actually think that's kind of brilliant that it was all the Black companions who were like, no, I know my worth. I'm going to. And it was all the white companions who were like, I'm going to be here till I die. And then they died.
That's what happens. Know your worth. Leave when you need to.
But that's just a little observation of, of mine.
There are two reasons that I love this episode. And one is that I just love werewolves. I find the whole concept of werewolves just fascinating. There's so many interesting avenues that you can take it. Anything that involves a werewolf, I'm probably going to like it. But the other reason that I like it is I love how Queen Victoria is written, specifically as a person of faith. Putting aside everything she is as a person, the way that she talks about faith and religion and grief and what that means and how it interacts, and specifically that moment where they're all around the dinner table and they're talking about ghost stories, and she and the doctor share this moment because they're both grieving. There's this shot of Tennant as Victoria is talking about how ghost stories are about hope. And it breaks my heart every time. Absolutely everything is written on that man's face.
Join Black Girls Create during the month of February for Black Wizard History Month, celebrating Black magical stories, characters, and fans. Attend weekly events, participate in the daily social media challenge, and more. To register, go to blackgirlscreate.org.
But yeah, no. This episode is absolutely written as a horror story, which, jumping straight off of New Earth and Christmas Invasion, is an interesting place to take it. And then next episode, we've got School Reunion, which is going to be so fun. But
I'm very excited.
Yes, we'll save that. We might save that announcement to the end, but it's very exciting. We've got plans, but it's a real departure from the Satan's Pit two-parter is also written. That's more of a supernatural thriller horror, but all of the other ones are very strictly romp. And I just find it fascinating that they decided to go so dark. It's very interesting.
Yeah. I really love The Impossible Planet and Satan Pit. Those are possibly two of my favorite episodes of the season.
Is there anything else you want to cover before we move on to favorite moments?
No, I think that was basically everything.
Two things I want to mention, just like as a sort of appendage to the whole, the reads and reads of unexamined privilege in the writing of this episode. It's wild to me that you have a joke about Margaret Thatcher being terrible, and then you have Queen Victoria in the same episode and then hold her up as like a good person. Like, wow. Okay. I just hate a cheap shot. Just do it properly, you know?
One thing I did actually like is the use of mistletoe, because I'm pretty sure mistletoe is actually toxic too.
Oh yeah, it is. It's massively toxic.
It's massively toxic. I know it's toxic to cats. I think it's also toxic to dogs. So that was
pretty sure it's toxic to humans. I find it fascinating, the whole mythology around mistletoe and everything about that being like, it's harmless. I'm like, it's not.
Yeah, no. Doctor licking it. I don't know. The doctor's not human.
Dr. Nick, stop licking stuff. Stop licking stuff. You have your magic little Sonic. Just point your Sonic at it. There need not be no touching.
You admitted the Sonic was magic.
I am just saying. I don't believe that it should not. I hate that it is magic, but it is magic. It's annoying. It should be scientific, but it just does whatever is needed. And that's magic. But yeah, he's just doing it because he wants to. That's literally the only reason. The 10th Doctor just likes to put his tongue on things.
Do you think he likes to put his tongue on Rose?
I was literally about to ask. Please. But no, he went there. I mean, apparently. All right. Favorite and least favorite moments. What have you got?
My least favorite moment is when the werewolf is in the cage and it's talking and is about to transform. I just find it sinister and creepy and gross in a way that makes me viscerally uncomfortable, and I can't quite explain it, but every time I think about it, it makes me want to be sick.
Yeah, no, I've actually got the same. It's the noises for me. No, I can't handle it. I literally skipped over that bit because I was like, not today. I can't do it. Literally like the 15 seconds or whatever it is, I'm like, no, I don't need to hear that.
Yeah. And then the favorite moment is when the doctor is in the library and he says, books, best weapons in the world. I like that line. I do think the way that they search through the library is slightly unreasonable because I'm slightly dubious about reading that many books.
Also, this man prepared for everything. You don't think he had an index somewhere or like catalog?
Like it would make more sense if he had a catalog and they looked through the catalog and found the thing. But randomly flipping through a book and randomly finding the page you needed seems so unreasonable to me. Another thing that seems unreasonable to me is all the books being in English.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, they're all in English because the TARDIS is nearby. We've established that already.
Okay. Not how translation works. I maintain, for the record, some of those books would have been in Latin and French and German. Just saying. The TARDIS is somehow translating it all into English and somehow the sentences are all making sense. But for the record, a man of that stature in the 18th century, some of those books would have been in Latin and French and German. Probably some in Spanish and Italian too.
I wonder what kind of translation bias the TARDIS has. Like, you know, when you read multiple translations of the same book and they're all slightly different because it's a person interpreting another person's work. Mm-hmm. And so everyone's going to be a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
What's the TARDIS bias like? TARDIS has got a bias.
Yeah, I wonder, because sometimes when things are translated out of different languages, like some languages have gender and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So how does it translate things that have gender?
Mm-hmm. Who knows? One of my favorite fan theories, because obviously Doctor Who is a family-friendly show, the TARDIS deliberately censors people. So basically the theory came about because everyone was like, Donna Noble would say fuck. Like, it doesn't make sense that this woman's keeping her language PG. I was like, do you know who is making it PG? The TARDIS. So that's my favorite translation theory. But yeah, no. I would say my favorite moment. I've got a tie. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Because it's the two moments that I've talked about. Because one of them I love for story reasons and one of them I love for meta reasons. But the meta reason is just David Tennant getting to use his natural accent. I love it. It's great. Just that whole... And again, sorry to get back on this road, but like even in that little scene where you have an actor who's Scottish and you've deliberately written this episode in a way that means that he gets to use his natural accent. And in the same scene that you're introducing the fact that he's speaking in this accent, you have a whole bit making fun of the accent. Someone needs to take Russell T. Davies to sensitivity training before he gets back in the chair. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, but my other favorite moment is the dinner scene where Victoria and the doctor talk about ghost stories. Because I am an angsty bitch at heart.
Those are both great scenes.
Here's the thing. I know we've only got 10 minutes. I hate self-sacrifice being lauded as heroic. We had this conversation during Father's Day, and it just really rubs me the wrong way that, first of all, Sir Robert was doing his bloody best. Like, like, I would like to see someone else do better. He was surrounded by kung fu monks in the middle of 18th century Scotland. He was doing his best.
I wanted to give the hero to Lady Isabel.
Yeah. I really liked Lady Isabel.
Yeah, she was pretty great.
She's pretty great. But also, like, I don't know, the Adam for this one is difficult because a lot of people were like mediocrely bad, but no one was god-awful. So there's a lot of weak contenders for second place.
Yeah, I was going to give it either to the head monk or the werewolf. Not the guy who's possessed by the werewolf, but the werewolf itself.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the werewolf. It feels, I don't know, it feels too easy giving the Adam to the villain. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, of course he was the bad guy. He's the bad guy. But like, was he the worst?
I mean, he like possessed a child and took over their entire life and killed a bunch of people.
I'm pretty sure that was the monks. Like, their whole dynamic fascinates me. What? That is such a chicken and egg dynamic. How does a singular cell suddenly start controlling an entire monastery? I'm so confused.
Why don't we give the monastery as an institution the Adam?
That sounds good. How about we give the British Empire the Adam? You know, like, let's just
let's give the British Empire the Adam.
That's it. All right. So hero, Lady Isabel, unfortunately part of the British Empire, and then Adam is the British Empire as a whole.
Is the British Empire. All right.
Rating. Production. Pretty good for the time. A lot of really obvious CGI, but...
No, we're giving it a 3-4 at best. You see that werewolf transformation? No. No. When it was caught up in the light beam? No. No. 3.
Everything else is really good.
The Kung Fu Monks?
That's a writing choice. Production had to do that because it was written already. I think they did well with what they had. That's RTD's fault.
Okay. I want to give it a 3.5.
All right.
That CGI was truly atrocious.
That CGI was from 2006, okay, on a TV budget.
Writing?
I'm torn. I think this is another three. I don't know. Maybe I'm getting it mixed up with rewatchability. I feel like it's very rewatchable, but when you actually look at it, so many things are bad.
It's not good. It's not good. I want to give it a three. Acting was a five. Acting was so good.
Acting's always five, apart from Christmas Invasion, because what the fuck. But
what did you think of Science? We didn't talk about Science at all.
We didn't talk about Science at all. I liked the Science overall. I liked that it was all tied together. Like, what I always said about Science is, as long as you can explain it in a world, I'm good. And they did that.
But how does a single cell take over a monastery?
I know. I know. And I know I brought that point up myself. But I guess what I mean is, I really like the solution. I really like the sort of marriage between science and magic in this episode and the way that it's considered the same thing. I do think that the whole werewolf mythology that they build for this werewolf is pretty stupid. within the context, yeah. So the setup makes no sense, but the solution I really like. Okay. So another three, maybe?
Okay. Rewatchability.
Rewatchability. I want to go with four.
Okay.
It's a fun episode. It's a good episode. It's a highly problematic episode.
I feel like I have to be in a certain mood to rewatch it. Like, when I'm in the right mood, I can watch it. If I'm in the wrong mood.
Much like, this is going to sound wild, but stay with me. Okay. It's the same vibe as an Indiana Jones movie.
I've never seen an Indiana Jones movie.
All right. Every single one of them is like a fun romp that's exciting and fun and has a lot of big moments and fun action scenes. And all of them are absolutely steeped in racism. Like, all of them are steeped in sexism. They're steeped in like every single possible problematic, like every single foot they put in their mouth. So you have to just like put that aside and decide that you're going to have a fun adventure. And that's what this episode feels like to me. It's a fun romp as long as you ignore 80% of it.
We got 74%. It's a C.
This is what you get when your writers don't examine their privilege. We could have had a good time. There was a way to do this that was not like this. Anyway. We hope you all had a good time listening to us talk about Tooth and Claw today. It's going to be very exciting. We've got school reunion coming up next. And guess what?
We've got a guest.
We've got our first guest. It's going to be really exciting. We've got Joy from Reality Bomb, who is incredibly cool and incredibly knowledgeable. And
we're going to have a great time talking about Sarah Jane Smith.
Uh-huh.
And so you should tune in for that in 2 weeks. We are doing every 2 weeks from now on because of Eve of the Daleks. We had our schedule a little bit scrunched up, but from now on, we're going to be releasing episodes every 2 weeks, except for when there's a bonus episode, we're going to squish them in there.
Yeah. So basically our regular schedule programming is going to be every 2 weeks, but when we've got live episodes happening, it's going to be co-current to whatever's actually airing. So yeah.
So
see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to the Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey podcast.
We hope you enjoyed this adventure with us through space and time.
You can find us elsewhere on the internet, on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram at WibblyPod. Follow us for more Wibbly Wobbly content.
You can find out more information about us and our content on wibblywobblytimeywimey.net and full transcripts for episodes at wibblywobblytimeywimey.net/transcripts.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can send us an email at wibblywobblytimeywimeypod@gmail.com.
Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and other platforms as it helps other people find us and our content.
That's all for now. Catch you in the time vortex.